This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In September 2023, the BBC Music Magazine checks on This Month in History, September 1899, where Grieg says non to Paris. On September 12th, 1899, Edvard Grieg did something few composers or performers ever do, turn down a lucrative high-profile booking with a leading orchestra. The invitation to guest conduct a concert of his own works with the Cologne Orchestra in Paris, where Grieg had appeared three times previously, would normally have been highly appealing. But the tone of the Norwegian composer's reply to Edvard Cologne, the concert's organizer, was unexpectedly sharp. "I cannot in all conscience travel to Paris," he wrote. "Like any other individual who is not a member of the French nation, I am shocked by the disgusting manner in which your compatriots treat both the law and the justice. And my disgust is so great that I have no desire to appear before a French audience." What had so piqued Grieg's ire that he found himself unable to accept Cologne's prestigious invitation? The answer lies in an event which happened 3 days earlier, when the French army officer Alfred Dreyfus was found guilty of treason for a second time. At his first court-martial 4 years previously, he was convicted for allegedly passing intelligence documents to the Germans. Grieg was not alone in finding the case against Dreyfus hopelessly unconvincing. Outraged, the novelist Émile Zola penned J'accuse, an open letter accusing the military authorities of corruption and distorting evidence. Public opinion swayed in Dreyfus's favor, although a virulent strain of anti-Semitism was also evident, not least among the military establishment. Grieg's gesture of solidarity with Dreyfus might easily have gone virtually unnoticed had he not authorized the publication of his letter to Cologne in a Frankfurt newspaper. There, the words of the eminent Norwegian composer stirred both approval from the pro-Dreyfus factions and bitter opposition from those who supported the treason verdict. Hate mail, including death threats, rained in Grieg's direction, and his controversial letter led to splits with friends and a string of cancelled concert engagements. Cologne himself was none too pleased that Grieg's letter had been published and that his orchestra had been associated with the ongoing Dreyfus furor. But he admired Grieg's music immensely and 3 years later invited him back to Paris to perform it. Grieg wanted to accept, but worried about the ongoing vitriol his Dreyfus stance was attracting. Cologne was reassuring. "The storm has passed," he commented. Unfortunately, it hadn't, as Grieg discovered when he arrived in Paris for his concert in April 1903. Dreyfus was by then a free man, having accepted a presidential pardon a week after his second trial. But memories of L'Affaire Dreyfus were still raw in the French capital, with controversies around it continuing to rage. A police escort was needed for Grieg and his wife to make the carriage ride from their hotel to the concert venue, where a milling crowd provided a mainly warm welcome. Boos and catcalls could be heard, however, as the composer came on stage to conduct the concert. Grieg stood silently by as police inside the hall forcibly ejected the agitators, and then took up his baton. "I energetically signaled the orchestra to open up with a fortissimo," he later reported, "and from that moment on, I was in complete control." Grieg was, though, shaken by the level of personal animosity he encountered while in Paris. The joyful celebrations which greeted his return to Norway, marking his 60th birthday, no doubt helped to reestablish a sense of personal well-being and belonging. But a scar remained. In the 4 years that were left until his death in 1907, he did not return to Paris again. In the December 2023, January 2024 edition of Pianist Magazine, John Evans tries to find out what qualities the winners of Pianist Magazine's amateur piano competition have in common. Pianist's inaugural amateur piano competition, which took place earlier this year, revealed the huge depth of piano-playing talent among followers. Of course, there could only be two winners, one each in the two categories classical and modern, but everyone who took part can count themselves a winner in terms of preparing their pieces to a high standard. So, as if we needed reminding, the competition revealed just what accomplished and ambitious followers pianist is privileged to have, but something else, too. Reviewing the list of highly placed and commended finishers, one thing stood out. Many enjoy successful careers in IT, medicine, and the sciences. True, some are also lawyers, financiers, and business people, but at least among the competition's highly placed participants, they were fewer in number. Why so? What is it about IT, medicine, and the sciences that attracts people to the piano? And not only that, but also to play it well? It's a question that many have sought an answer to for years. An ability at mathematics, a concept closely related to these careers, is the attribute most often referred to in this context. No formal research appears to have been done into the relationship between music and maths, but there are plenty of theories and much anecdotal evidence to suggest a link exists. Among the former, the one most quoted is music's similarity to mathematics in the way its building blocks, rhythm, scales, harmony, and pitch, are calculated and relate to each other. There's also a puzzle-solving aspect to understanding and navigating a score, and a tendency for the music to form patterns that would be familiar to a mathematician. On this point, Catherine Page, one of the competition's judges and a teacher, adjudicator, and administrator for Chetham's International Summer School in Manchester, says the evidence is clear. At Chetham's, many students who are high flyers in maths, computing, and the sciences are also high flyers on their instruments. I am sure it is to do with their fast processing speeds and a logical approach to working out solutions. Many of our younger students, aged 8 and 9, are often seen playing and solving Rubik's Cubes quickly and easily. For them, music is another puzzle to be solved, so they're able to understand and assimilate what's on the musical page very quickly. Although all this mathematics and problem-solving might seem a world away from music's power to move performers and listeners, mathematicians argue that numbers themselves can be beautiful, and that mathematics can be as moving as music. Mathematicians would actually object to the idea that maths isn't interested in beauty, says Simra Haskell, professor of mathematics at the USC Dornsife College of Letters, Arts, and Sciences in California, who plays the violin. When I write down a proof of a result in mathematics, it feels like a puzzle coming together. There can be an intense pleasure in that, similar to the pleasure I feel when I listen to a beautiful piece of music or gaze at a beautiful painting or go for a walk in the mountains, on the beach, or in a wood. But does this appreciation of mathematical beauty, combined with an aptitude for problem-solving, necessarily persuade someone first to play the piano and second to play it well? Rob Rennie was the winner of the competition's modern category. He is a software engineer and lives in the U.S. He believes his early exposure to computers and programming has informed his approach to the piano. My dad brought a computer home when I was a kid, and once I could build a program, he couldn't get me off it, he recalls. Even after 40 years, I still love it. I like it the most when I, or a team I'm working with, is actively creating or building a new piece of software. I like it the least when the software is in maintenance mode or just fixing bugs. I will try to find a new greenfield project when that happens. In part inspired by the organ his father played, when it wasn't broken, Rennie started playing the piano, although only in earnest when he left home after high school. I don't know why I started playing the piano. It was just in me. It felt like a piece of a puzzle had fallen into place, and I became obsessed with understanding and not just learning it. Come to think of it, there is an isolated obsessive focus to both my computer science and piano science studies. In both pursuits, there is a coherent mental model I'm trying to reach. Rennie's experience makes a strong argument for there being a link between math, or in his case, computer programming and music. Later in the same conversation, he brings us back to Earth with an alternative theory, that the competition's entry requirements may actually have encouraged people with a background in IT and the sciences to respond. Because the contest required the skill to create a video, copy it to something like Dropbox, fill out a PDF, email it, and so on. Perhaps there were quite a few IT folks who responded to this contest because of their familiarity with these processes. Nevertheless, Rennie's account of being obsessed with the piano is something Professor Adam Ockleford of the Center for Learning, Teaching, and Human Development at the University of Roehampton in London observes in the savants he works with. Such people are notable for their exceptional abilities in a particular field, while having significant impairment in others. These people are motivated to do one thing extremely well at the expense of everything else, says Ockleford, an authority on music and psychology who has worked extensively with Derek Pottavicini, the celebrated pianist and savant. To a lesser degree, the same applies to blind people. Many of them have perfect pitch, since sound enables them to make sense of the world. Based on his experience, Ockleford rejects the idea, floated in some quarters, of a neural substrate or musical gene enabling savants like Paravicini to play the piano to a remarkably high standard. By extension, he also dismisses the notion of a gene deftly enabling mathematicians, scientists, physicians, and IT workers to play the piano better than those pursuing other professions. Instead, he believes the experience Rennie describes of doggedly learning to program a computer and the attitude of mind this early exposure to problem solving instilled in him is one of the keys to being able to play an instrument, such as the piano, well. Social rather than musical factors explain our ability to play music, he says. The attitudinal, psychological, and environmental evidence is overwhelming. As to whether an ability at math automatically translates into an ability to play music, Ockleford is equally clear. Most musicians are hopeless at maths. You don't need an algorithm to catch a ball. Instead, you catch it instinctively. Similarly, you don't need to understand maths to play the piano and feel the music. Catherine Page would agree. Her own children are not good at maths, she says, but are fantastic musicians. We've examined how maths or the sciences and IT might benefit music, but for Noah DeGarmo, a U.S.-based physician whose playing was highly commended in the competition's classical category, it is music that has benefited his medical career. The skills I learned as a child, spending hours concentrating on practicing, helped to provide a base for my medical work. Medicine requires intense concentration, and emergency medicine requires an insane amount of multitasking, which is similar to playing the piano in that with each piece there are always many things going on at once. DeGarmo began learning the piano at the age of 7, but at 16 made the decision to follow a career in medicine when, tragically, his father died of a heart attack. His death sparked my interest in medicine. I knew that being a musician is a hard career, and that only a select few succeed, so I wanted to choose a career where I could help people, but keep music as a serious hobby and something that I love with a passion. Inevitably, both pursuits overlap to some degree. For example, he enjoys the challenges presented by complex medical cases, just as he enjoys the challenge of preparing, playing, and performing classical music. I have many friends in medicine who are also classical musicians, he says. There is definitely a link between the two. So far in this article, those with an ability in maths, IT, and the sciences claim no special musical gifts. Rather, they say it's how these abilities inform their approach to a piece of music that helps them to master and enjoy it. Graham Scott, head of the School of Keyboard Studies at the Royal Northern College of Music, agrees. Of course, there are similarities between music and maths. Form, structure, and rhythm are all based around numbers. However, having the kind of clear-headed, analytical approach associated with someone with mathematical ability is extremely helpful when preparing and analyzing music and meeting its various challenges. Certainly, a high proportion of our students possess excellent analytical and numerical skills. However, music encompasses everything from the physical to the emotional. Math is just one aspect of it. To truly be a musician, you need emotional commitment and communicative power. These last two points are easily forgotten in any discussion around maths and playing the piano. Ability in the former may help one be a better pianist, but the ability to connect with your listener, to move them and to take them on your musical journey, are not learned by programming a computer. Which is not to say the competition's highly placed finishers are deficient in this respect. For example, regarding Rennie's performance, the judges were full of praise for his energy, his ability to communicate his love for the music, his atmospheric, gentle, and sensitive playing, and his passion and feeling for the music.
I would say that I lean towards the emotional side, says Rennie. In fact, this is a characteristic I see among the musicians I know in analytical careers. I don't think you can create compelling music without imbuing it with your emotions, and you have to have emotions to do that.
Meanwhile, DeGarmo says that his goal in every performance is to get the listener out of themselves and evoke emotion in whatever form that may be. Alanis Mikhailova, a biochemist in the U.S. who was commended for her playing in the classical category, says that what she enjoys most about playing the piano is making sound and music, becoming a part of beautiful compositions and being able to experience emotions and ideas put together by a composer. These are not the words of pianists happy just to analyze scores, work out fingerings, and count beats. Rather, they show a high degree of musical intelligence. We'll leave the final words to Rennie.
In both disciplines, computer programming and piano playing, we are trying or reaching for something out there that we have to pull in through our heads and get out through these funny little contrived devices. We have some guides, whether it's a programming tutorial or sheet music or teachers. But ultimately, what is created at the end is inherently and impossible not to be unique. Maybe we're just enjoying tapping into something quantum mechanical, something that, until we observe it, doesn't really exist. I'm starting to get a little goofy, so I'm going to stop thinking about it and just go play.
In Fanfare Cincinnati for March of 2022, Jonathan Kramer discusses Brahms' First Symphony. Brahms was only 20 years old and had written only a small amount of music when he received a press review of enviable praise. The reviewer was Robert Schumann. Schumann wrote, "If he will dip his magic wand where the powers of the choral and orchestral masses will lend him their strength, then there will appear before us even more wonderful glimpses into the secrets of this spiritual world." With this review, Schumann laid a heavy burden on young Brahms. By mentioning choral and orchestral masses, he was clearly invoking Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Brahms, who had not yet written anything for orchestra, was being told publicly that he could, should, and probably would take up where Beethoven had left off. He had decided to approach the orchestra gradually. The composition of a symphony would have to wait. After he had composed for small orchestra and for piano and orchestra, he wrote for chorus and orchestra. Finally, in 1873, he created the Variations on a Theme of Haydn, which began life as a two-piano work only, subsequently to be orchestrated. Now at last he felt ready to start and finish a symphony. Actually, some of the materials of the First Symphony had already been in existence for a number of years. Brahms had sent Clara Schumann a sketch of the first movement, minus its famous introduction, in 1862, and he had sent her a birthday song in 1868 using the horn theme from the finale. But it was only in 1876 that the composer completed the symphony in C minor. That was 22 years after Schumann's review had prompted him to think about composing in symphonic form. Why did it take Brahms so long to finish a symphony? The answer lies in the influence of Beethoven. As Schumann's review implies, the figure of Beethoven loomed over the entire 19th century like that of Big Brother. He was studied, admired, misunderstood, emulated, and canonized, not only by every composer, but also by other artists. The titanism of Beethoven, his image as the great liberator of art from the constraints of classicism, became a rallying cry for the self-consciously free spirit of Romanticism. When the C minor symphony was first performed, conductor Hans von Bülow dubbed it the Tenth, thereby declaring Schumann's prophecy fulfilled. Bülow recognized the affinity between the two great composers who, reaching across the intervening half-century of Romanticism, established contact as Romantic classicists. Brahms was attempting an all but impossible task, that of living up to the genius of Beethoven. In 1870, he said, "I shall never compose a symphony. You have no idea how the likes of us feel when we hear the tramp of a giant like him behind us." Yet he succeeded in becoming a symphonist. He did not recapture Beethoven, but in trying to do so, he found himself. It took Brahms 22 years to learn how to use the orchestra symphonically. That period was hardly an apprenticeship, considering the long list of fine works composed while he struggled to create a symphony. During those years, he worked to tame and control his romanticism, to merge inspiration and intellect, to understand Beethoven deeply, and to mold his own symphonic thoughts. The result of this incredible struggle for self-discipline is undoubtedly the greatest First Symphony ever composed. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.